time we got there. At one of our stops in Pasadena, a guy tried to pass off a redhead as a brunette. "Well, you must be fucking colorblind," my dad yelled at the guy as he pulled me down the driveway. We finally got lucky on a Sunday afternoon in Downey. I'll never forget the pastel floral pattern of the woman's house dress as she placed the doll in my arms. Her birth certificate said Ava, but I called her Cara Alicia. I felt like the proudest little mama in the whole world, and my dad smiled down at me and said, "You better love that goddamn doll until you die." Because I grew up in Los Angeles, many of my childhood memories seemed to take place in the car. Whenever we had something to do downtown or on the east side of LA, my dad would drive down to the Nickel to show me all the homeless people and junkies. Just like that super offensive scene in Vacation where they take a wrong turn and end up in the bad part of St. Louis and Chevy's character Clark says, "Ellen, it's good for them. We can't turn a blind eye to the plight of the inner city. Kids, are you noticing all this plight?" That was my dad. The Nickel was the nickname for Fifth Street in downtown LA, which at the time looked like a cross between The Walking Dead, New Jack City, and Slumdog Millionaire. One time when I was about 7, we turned the corner and almost ran into 2 men in the middle of the street beating the crap out of each other. "Shit," my dad gasped, part fascinated, part horrified, part terrified, as he threw the car in reverse and sped the wrong way down the one-way street until we were clear of the melee. When we would visit Chicago, he would make a detour to show me Cabrini Green, one of the most disenfranchised and crime-ridden housing projects in the country at that time. I don't really know why he did this. Was it a voyeur thing? Was he trying to teach me about poverty and systemic racism? Was he feeling nostalgic about his year of teaching in the projects? Was he somehow attuned to my interest in social justice before I even knew what it was? I never asked him directly, but I always enjoyed these little windows into other worlds, and he seemed to, too. Hopefully by this point it goes without saying, but my dad was great at making things fun that might otherwise have been a drag. When I would get out of the bath at night, he would transform into Mr. Charles, a flamboyantly gay hairdresser. "Well, hello, little girl. What a gorgeous head of hair you have. Would you like a side part, middle part, or should we take it straight back?" he would ask as he liberally doused my curls with no more tangles. I hated having my hair combed. Hated it. It always knotted up overnight, and by the end of the day, it would look like a rat's nest. I would cry every time my mom did it, but of course, her tactic was to say, "Keep crying, don't stop. I'm gonna get my camera," which would usually make me stop crying immediately. Those dewy curls, which I have since learned to love, were endlessly trying for all of us, and even Mr. Charles had his limits. Apparently, no one had ever told Mr. Charles that peanut butter could get gum out of hair, so my dad once used turpentine when I fell asleep with a mouthful of Big League Chew. I was not happy about having to sit still for 2 hours while he worked the gum out of my tangles with a smelly rag. He was not happy about not being able to smoke while dousing my head in flammable solvent. Another time, Mr. Charles forgot to brush my hair for a week when I had the flu, and then had to pay some nice ladies at the hair salon to spend half a day combing out my massive dreadlocks. Mr. Charles also sometimes became Mr. Schmendrick, the shoe salesman, who would inquire in a thick Yiddish accent, "Can I interest you in a moccasin today? How about a nice Mary Jane?" I was like my dad's little doll, and he was my own personal one-man show. Sweet as they were, these theatrics left little time or energy for some of the other concrete requirements of parenting, like, say, feeding your kid. In a 1983 article in the Chicago Tribune magazine, my dad discussed our unorthodox habits. "We eat like animals. We basically stand around the refrigerator eating uncooked food. We lost the habit of sitting down together. Anne is not a housewife by any stretch of the imagination. I'll roast a piece of meat like a caveman and eat it with some Diet Pepsi. Violet eats mainly frozen waffles and hot dogs. I gotta tell you, we don't bother with plates. We don't have to wash them. Anne eats chicken about 6 or 7 nights a week, mainly chicken and pineapple." My mom had a complicated relationship with food, so she was often on one fad diet or another and preferred to eat alone. At home, I ate mostly cold cereal, hot dogs, and anything that could be made in a toaster oven, waffles, tater tots, and French bread pizza. My dad was always a voracious eater, even as the string bean he was in his late 30s. So if he didn't feel like making himself a steak and baked potato, we went out for Chinese food at Hunan Gardens or to McDonald's. My dad would eat a McRib, quarter pounder with cheese, 6-piece chicken McNuggets, and a chocolate shake. I would get a Happy Meal. I know McDonald's is disgusting, but thinking about the joy on my dad's face as he slurped sweet and sour sauce out of the little white tub, free dessert, still makes me smile. Clearly, I grew up with few rules and very little structure, and it didn't just extend to meals. Bedtime? What was that? After I took a bath and Mr. Charles did my hair, my dad and I would watch TV until one or both of us started to doze. If he fell asleep first, I would finish watching whatever was on, then wake him up to tuck me in. He would put me in bed and say, "I'll be back to check on you in 10 minutes. "How many seconds is that?" I would mumble into my pillow. 600 seconds, he would say, kissing the back of my head. "Okay." I would count dutifully, but always passed out before making it to 600. To this day, when I can't sleep, I start counting and think about my dad, just in the next room, coming back in to check on me soon. Our AV Club. My childhood was full of singing. From Sam Cooke to Simon and Garfunkel, Ella Fitzgerald to Elton John, James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Eric Clapton, Harry Nilsson, Peter, Paul and Mary, Sweet Honey and the Rock, you name them, my dad sang them. He had a beautiful acoustic guitar and a sweet, warm singing voice. As a lifelong Beatles fan, he loved to play their songs. In My Life, Yesterday, Here, There, and Everywhere, and You've Got to Hide Your Love Away were some of his favorites. When I was very small, he would do verse after verse of Hole in the Bucket, hysterically acting out Dear Henry's haplessness and Dear Liza's increasing frustration. Later, I would bring home songs from school or camp, and he would pick them out on his guitar. The Cowboys' Lament, depressing as it was on heavy rotation with us for years. I used to love it when my mom and dad sang together, especially this random Czech folk song, Studla Pampa. Started out very soft and sweet, and then came in with a surprisingly loud and boisterous polka chorus. At 6 years old, I couldn't get enough, and it was nice to see them enjoying something together, too, however small. I don't really know what my parents' relationship was like at this point. From where I stood, they seemed to have pretty separate lives. They had come a long way together, but just didn't seem to have much overlap anymore. My mom was focused on her art, and my dad on his work. This isn't to say that I was neglected, but we just didn't spend a ton of family time together. Singing in the car on the way to a party or friend's house was the exception. By far, my dad's and my favorite thing to sing together had to have been Les Miserables. We saw the stage show several times, listened to different cast recordings. He liked Patti LuPone as Fantine, I was not as enamored. And we watched all of the anniversary specials on PBS. We always put a lot of heart into our renditions, switching back and forth between the characters, alternately laughing and crying as the story progressed. After my dad got sick, I would sing Les Mis to entertain him. I'd make my voice extra nasal or add in ridiculous choreography, anything to make him smile. Now I still sing it sometimes, but it mostly makes me cry. "You will live, Papa, you're going to live. It's too soon to say goodbye. Yes, Cosette, forbid me now to die. I'll obey. I will try." Movies were also a big part of my life from an early age. Dad and I would go to The Warehouse, our local video store, every Friday after school to rent movies for the weekend. As I'm sure you can imagine, there wasn't a lot of discussion about age appropriateness, so I was exposed to a lot of things early on that, looking back, are hard to believe. Midnight Express, The Elephant Man, Quest for Fire, Eating Raoul, The Dresser, Flashdance, Cotton Club, Never Cry Wolf, After Hours, and Blue Velvet were all movies I'd seen, many in the theater, by the time I was 10. Violence was fine, apparently, but Dad did try to cover my eyes when Linda Hamilton's breasts popped up on screen in The Terminator. Thanks, Dad, for trying to spare me the trauma. One of my favorite early 80s movies was Coal Miner's Daughter, starring Sissy Spacek as Loretta Lynn. I probably watched it 5 times every weekend for a couple of months when I was around 6. Superficially, I suppose I liked that Lynn fell in love with a boy her parents didn't approve of, ran off with him, had a bunch of babies, and still became a big, glamorous star. Her abusive husband and eventual issues with addiction only made it that much more dramatic and alluring to me. I would put on my fanciest nightgown, shiny synthetic material with an empire waist and ruffled cap sleeves, and sing my little heart out into a hairbrush in front of the full-length mirror in my parents' bedroom. My dad thought it was adorable, for a few weeks. Then he kindly but firmly suggested that we rent something else when Friday rolled around. Reflecting on it now, I think I was comforted by Lynn's unbreakable connection to her dad. No matter how big her life got, no matter how far she strayed from home, even long after he died, in her heart she was still just her daddy's little girl. It's not very feminist, I know, but it was true for Loretta, and it's true for me, and I'll keep singing it into a hairbrush for as long as I live. After my parents separated, my dad and I would go out alone once a week to dinner and a movie. I called it Divorce Dad Night. It usually involved Sizzler or good old Hunan Gardens and whatever was playing at the Arrow, Wilshire, or Lemley Theater. Whether I was living with him or my mom or switching back and forth, Divorce Dad Night was our time, and I cherished it. When I was 15, we went to see Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant. You'd think that after all the other twisted movies I'd seen, neither one of us would bat an eye, but my dad turned to me in the theater as Harvey Keitel masturbated on a teenage girl's face and mouthed, "I'm so sorry." It was one of the more awkward divorced dad nights, I admit, but I didn't care. It was all part of the mess, and it wasn't all sex, drugs, and depravity. We laughed hysterically together over Love and Death, Noises Off, Three Amigos, Monty Python's Life of Brian, Unfaithfully Yours, A Night at the Opera, and other classics, too. For better or worse, I've carried on the tradition of wildly inappropriate cinema with my own kids. Some of the highlights include 21 Jump Street, Kill Bill, White Man Can't Jump, and Working Girl. Now, when I suggest a movie to my daughter, she immediately asks, "Is there nudity? How many times do they show boobs?" One of my favorite movies as a kid was The Blue Lagoon, and when I showed it to my daughter Karina a couple years ago, I was a little shocked. How did they even get away with making that movie? Of course, she loved all the things about it that I had loved as a girl. Children on their own, nudity, sex, and of course, childbirth. Now she's moved on to Law and Order Special Victims Unit. At first, I tried to limit which episodes she would watch. "Mom," she yells from her brother Keon's room, "can I watch the next episode? It's about hate crimes, not rape." Okay, I guess," I stammer. "Mother of the year," my husband jokes, mouthing, "you'll be sorry." Although my taste in music and movies may have changed over the years, I was always grateful to my dad for giving me such a solid foundation in both. He wasn't someone who had the radio on all the time, but there was always music in him. And he cried at every movie, no matter how corny it was. I think both of these things were important to him because he was such a balanced, reserved person in every other area of his life. So belting out Bridge Over Troubled Water, weeping through Legally Blonde, or growling along with Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men wasn't just entertaining, it was my dad's emotional outlet. Despite his first-hand nuts-and-bolts knowledge of the production process, Dad was always a sucker for the magic of movies and remained an ardent and sentimental cinephile throughout his life. Ghostbusters, 1984. Written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. Directed by Ivan Reitman. After being booted from their plum positions at a New York university, three paranormal scientists, Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, go into business as Ghostbusters, capturing and containing supernatural beings all over the city. A fourth buster, Ernie Hudson, joins the team as spectral activity soars and the business becomes wildly successful. While investigating a disturbance on the Upper West Side, the team discovers a gateway to another dimension and must ultimately battle Gozer, an ancient god of destruction, to save New York City from annihilation. Egon. Print is dead. Janine. That's very fascinating to me. I read a lot myself. Some people think I'm too intellectual, but I think it's a fabulous way to spend your spare time. I also play racquetball. Do you have any hobbies? Egon. I collect spores, molds, and fungus. On balance, Ghostbusters is a hoot. It's Murray's picture, and in a triumph of mind over matter, he blows away the film's boring special effects with his one-liners. Gene Siskel, Chicago Tribune. This movie is an exception to the general rule that big special effects can wreck a comedy. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. Whoever thought of having evil's final manifestation take the form of a 100-foot marshmallow deserves the rational mind's eternal gratitude. Richard Schickel, Time. The original idea for Ghostbusters arose out of Dan Aykroyd's lifelong interest in the paranormal. An early draft, intended for himself and John Belushi, opened in a future world where Ghostbusters was an established and franchised company with paramedic-like teams all over the country. Dan's story was intergalactic and very technical, heavy on action sequences and light on character development. Ivan wanted to focus the story on the origins of the Ghostbusters and pull the action down to earth, so he brought my dad in to add structure and differentiate the three leads. Dad frequently described the three of them as the brains, the heart, and the mouth. I'll let you figure out who was who. Working on a very tight schedule, my dad and Dan wrote separately and then rewrote each other with major input from Ivan. Dan Aykroyd was always quick to acknowledge what my dad brought to the writing table. Harold added the irony, the heart, the romance with Sigourney Weaver, and all the adult writing as well as the structure. And he knew which passes to throw to Bill so Bill would look funny throughout, he said in The New Yorker in 2004. The mood surrounding Ghostbusters was reminiscent of the confidence around Animal House. My dad recalled, "When we were doing Ghostbusters, Dan, Ivan, and I had the feeling that this was going to be huge. People were going to love it. We had a great sense of each other and what we could contribute. I'm sorry if it sounds arrogant to say that it wasn't a surprise, but it's really satisfying because it didn't feel that surprising." It's odd because this confidence could easily read as egotism, and yet my dad was always such a grounded, humble person. I guess when you're part of a comedy dream team, there's no use denying it. During the filming, my dad and I lived at the Sherry Netherland Hotel in New York City, while my mom stayed in Santa Monica for most of the summer. I loved the Sherry because it was very fancy, and being there made me feel like a little princess. And being in the city was endlessly fascinating to me. New York in the 1980s was very different than it is today. Just map the trajectory from Basquiat to Bloomberg to de Blasio. But some things never change. The energy of the city was exciting and edgy, and I loved bopping around with my babysitter, a young woman from upstate named Joey. After our mandatory hour of schoolwork, we would eat hot dogs and pretzels and go to a museum or Central Park and then go visit the set. I had been on movie sets before, but this one felt different somehow, even to 6-year-old me. Like they knew the movie was going to be huge, but no one wanted to jinx it by acting too cocky. There was a sense of excitement, and it was an infectious feeling, even extending to the extras. The crowd scenes in the movie with groups of mohawked punks, Wall Street suits, Orthodox Jews, and fancy rich ladies may seem now like caricature, but it really reflected part of what New York City was at the time. An edgy mix of cultures, classes, and lifestyles playing out their differences to the extreme. On the day they filmed the exterior scene where the Ghostbusters run out of the New York Public Library, a crowd had gathered to watch as usual. Bill, Dan, and my dad, dressed as Venkman, Stance, and Spengler, came tearing through the doors and down the stairs on the first take. But a lens cap went flying off the camera Stance wore around his neck. "Cut!" Ivan shouted while they reset the scene, making sure that cap was on tightly. "Action," Ivan yelled, and they came barreling through the doors again. This time, one of the gadgets around my dad's neck fell off and went bouncing down the steps. "Cut," Ivan yelled again as a props person scurried to secure the piece. "Action," he called again once everything was in place. Again, something came loose and went flying as they charged down the steps. "Cut," Ivan said, getting annoyed. "Let's get it all locked down now, come on." The props people went through everything, shaking and jostling to make sure nothing was loose. The spectators were giggling and making friendly bets that something else would fall off. I remember feeling worried because my dad had the most gadgets and therefore the most potential to drop something, and I didn't want Ivan to be mad at him. I held my breath as he called action and crossed my fingers that everything would hold. It did. The trio made it to the bottom of the stairs with all their gear intact, and when Ivan called cut with a big smile on his face, the crowd let out a round of applause. It seemed like New Yorkers were rooting for Ghostbusters from the start, and I think that New York feeling is one of the things that makes the film really great. At the end of the movie, when Winston Zeddemore yells, "I love this town," you can't help but love it too. That feeling of being on the verge of something really cool carried back to the sound stages in LA, where they finished the shooting schedule. Even though I went back to my normal life, I still visited the set often and got to see some of the iconic scenes being filmed. Dana, possessed by Zool, floating above the bed, a la The Exorcist. Gozer, played by a hot, androgynous Yugoslavian supermodel, coming down the crystal staircase. The special effects team was doing some really innovative stuff, and everyone seemed eager to show off their new toys. Being able to see behind the scenes may have dampened my appreciation for the movie when it actually came out, but everyone else was going nuts. When people would ask me if I liked the movie, I would say, "It's not my favorite." I was definitely in the minority on that, but to be fair, 1984 was a great year for movies. The Karate Kid, Footloose, Breakin', Splash, Romancing the Stone, I mean, come on. All the boys in my third grade class were obsessed with Ghostbusters and would swarm around my dad when he came to pick me up. "Egon, Egon, can I have your autograph?" Even though he wasn't the cool guy in the movie, he was the coolest dad at school, hands down. We both loved every minute of it. I don't think I actually really enjoyed Ghostbusters until I was about 15 and watched it at my friend Jay's house. All of a sudden, the jokes I was too young for in 1984 were hilarious, and those scenes I had watched them shoot over and over and over again seemed fresh and fun. I called my dad at his office when the movie ended and told him, "Okay, Ghostbusters was really good. I get it now." "Phew," he chuckled. "Glad you finally came around." Because Ghostbusters was such an iconic movie, it created an enormous and passionate fan base. My dad did several Make-A-Wish visits as Egon and received ardent letters from awkward, brainy people and those who loved them from all over the world. Even 20 years after the fact, Ghostbusters was the thing that my dad was most often recognized for and asked about. Whereas other people may have been frustrated by having their life's work reduced to a Twinkie, he never seemed to tire of it and proudly worked to keep the Ghostbusters legacy alive. Ch-ch-ch-changes. In 1983, my parents decided to upgrade their lifestyle in anticipation of the success of Ghostbusters. They bought a new house a few blocks away from our little 11th Street cottage, and my mom got a new car to replace her enormous Pontiac Bonneville, a boxy Volvo station wagon that she had painted in a ballet slipper pink. For my 6th birthday, my mom decided to throw me a huge party in the new place since it was empty and waiting to be gutted. We went wild, drawing all over the walls, smushing potato chips into the orange shag carpet, and digging our fingers into the birthday cake. I was allowed to invite everyone in my school, and all my parents' cool friends were there. It was awesome. Eventually, the house was redesigned and renovated by my mom and the wonderful architect Brian Murphy. It was a 1980s fantasy land. Pink, black, and aqua tiles everywhere. Carpet made to look like pink and aqua tiles. Splatter-painted couch, glass brick and turquoise dining room with a glass table and stainless steel chairs. Green corrugated fiberglass deco accents. Truly, it was like living through the looking glass. At the time, I was going to a small private school in Santa Monica called PS1, with about 60 kids, kindergarten through 6th grade. There weren't really grade levels or report cards, and we called the teachers by their first names. I have fond but chaotic memories of PS1. When the whole school went on a camping trip to Leo Carrillo State Beach, my parents forgot to pack my pajamas, so I froze all night in my leotard jeans, moccasins, and flimsy sleeping bag, as I looked enviously at my classmates, cozy in their long johns and actual camping gear. The next day, I gathered hundreds of tiny tadpoles in a jar, excited to bring them back home and watch them turn into little frogs. Sadly, the jar wasn't closed tightly, and when I opened my duffel bag to show my dad our new pets, all we found were hundreds of squished tadpoles. I went to PS1 until what I thought was third grade, but then ended up doing third grade again at Franklin Elementary, our local public school. My parents were concerned that I was falling behind and needed a more structured environment. Going from a pluralistic school with about 60 kids in a converted house to a public school with more than 300 students was a big adjustment and didn't go particularly well. At 8, I didn't have the social skills to integrate myself smoothly into an established group of friends. Plus, I was tall for my age, with a big, unruly head of curls. Kids teased me about my name, about my hair, about being an early bloomer, even about my dad. What had once been an unquestionable asset was now a liability. "Hey, Purple. Hey, you big hairy mountain. Who's your dad? Kurt Rambis? Purple Rambis? No? Oh yeah, he's that other nerd." So fucking mean. Other kids definitely had it worse, but I wasn't used to the harshish reality of public school in the wealthy north side of Santa Monica. Unfortunately, this experience made me both more compassionate and more cruel. Once I had overcome the hump of being the new kid, i.e. easiest target, I still got shit from people, but I wasn't the lowest on the totem pole anymore. I then turned on other vulnerable kids and probably made some people pretty miserable over the years. Hopefully no permanent damage was done, but if you're one of the people who I unleashed my rage on and tortured mercilessly at any point from 1984 to 1995, I am truly sorry. This was probably the first time that I recognized how my unusual upbringing, while enriching and entertaining, was not really giving me the tools that I needed to function in the world. It's easy to be an oddball when your whole life is like a sideshow, but try being a little bearded lady in a sea of perky blonde ponytails and see how it works out for you. My dad would always tell me, "Different is good, don't worry about what everyone else is doing." And while this seemed to be a winning formula for him, all I wanted to do was blend in and have some semblance of a normal life. It was around this time that I first met my stepmother, Erica Mann, when she came in to interview at Ocean Pictures, the production company my dad ran with Trevor Albert and at that point Michael Schamberg. My dad and Michael met on their first day of college at WashU and became fast friends. Michael was one of the founders of the TVTV Collective, Top Value Television, in the 1970s, and my dad collaborated with them as an actor and director on a series depicting the fictional history of television for KCET. Trevor was a production assistant on Caddyshack and was also the man behind the gopher puppet in several scenes. He and my dad had gotten along so well they decided to keep working together for the next 25 years. Ocean Pictures' first project was Club Paradise, and my dad needed an assistant who could do the high-intensity work of coordinating pre-production and picking me up from school. Although Erica had worked in the film industry for several years and was very clear in her interview that she was not comfortable doing personal errands, once she got the job, she quickly realized that she was okay with adding me into the mix of her other responsibilities. "I was so adamant about the job description," she recalled. "I was at a point where I really wanted to be taken seriously, and I knew that wouldn't happen if I was running around picking up dry cleaning. But then when I met you, I just couldn't help myself. I told your dad, 'I know I said no personal stuff, but if you ever need me to pick Violet up or watch her, I'd be totally fine with it.' What can I say? I was irresistible." When Erica started at Ocean Pictures, she was 29, chain-smoked larks, and looked like a hippie version of Katharine Hepburn. She would pick me up after school and bring me to the office to play and hang out, or to her apartment, where she would fry up chicken livers for her cat, Ming. A few times she took me to lunch with her father and made me promise not to tell him she smoked. I liked having a secret with her, and even more, liked the power that secret gave me. I considered spilling the beans a few times, but she would catch my eye, see my impish smile, and make a funny monster face, so I just let it be. Erica temporarily took on more of a nanny role in addition to her production duties during an extended scouting trip we took to the Caribbean while my dad and Brian Doyle Murray were finishing the script for Club Paradise. We spent about 3 weeks on the island of Nevis at the Nisbet Plantation Inn. It was pretty much paradise for me. No school, hanging on the beach every day, and a group of local kids to play with. The manager of the hotel was a cranky old Brit who taught me to play cricket and tend bar. The local kids, Tessan, Winky, Clive, and Desiree, were a few years older than me, but would come to the hotel beach after school. The hotel manager, being a classic old-school colonial-style racist, didn't like them and threatened to have his dogs chase them off the property. When he saw how horrified we were by this, he backed off, and the kids were allowed to hang out with us as much as they wanted while we were there. Clive especially loved my dad and would just stand next to him, sometimes reaching out to touch the hair on his arm, but mostly just observing while Dad and Brian smoked, wrote, and made each other cry with laughter. Erica and I had a lot of fun together during those times. She didn't have much experience with children, but I wasn't exactly a typical kid, so it worked out well. She liked my spunk and sass, and I appreciated her sweetness and easy laughter. The whole trip seemed like heaven to me, but was probably not so idyllic for Erica, because, as you can probably imagine, I was used to doing whatever I wanted and was not always very easy to take care of. Take, for example, my attitude toward maintaining a clean space. "Why don't you pick up your clothes and toys off the floor before we go to dinner?" "No, I'm not going to." "Violet, I'm the adult, and you have to listen to me." "No, I don't. I'm going to tell my daddy."
"You can tell him," she said, "but I think he'll agree that..."
"No," I explained. "I'm going to tell my daddy to fire you." And then I would run right to my dad, take a hold of his hand, and smile sweetly at Erica over my shoulder as he escorted me to dinner. What a brat, right? Well, all my threats obviously backfired in a major way. They were ultimately married for 25 years and had two wonderful children together, so I guess I learned my lesson. Club Paradise, 1986. Written by Harold Ramis and Brian Doyle Murray, directed by Harold Ramis. Retired Chicago firefighter Jack Moniker, Robin Williams, takes off for the Caribbean and teams up with reggae singer Ernest Reed, Jimmy Cliff, to open a resort. As the first group of guests arrive, ready for luxurious fun in the sun, Jack scrambles against all odds to keep them happy. Instead of being able to kick back and enjoy the island life, Jack and Ernest have to contend not only with their unhappy customers, but with civil war, as greedy land developers collude with corrupt politicians to take over the island and put Club Paradise out of business. Mr. Zerby. "Ernest, I know this business. A guy who just paid $32 for a bad veal Oscar doesn't want to know that the band is angry." "The movie is painless and everybody associated with it is good company, but considering the obvious effort and the expense that went into it, the result should have been much, much better." Vincent Canby, The New York Times. "A frenetically unfunny and charmless movie." Sheila Benson, Los Angeles Times. "What's fresh about Ramis and Doyle Murray's brand of comedy is that they're not one-liner wordsmiths, they're social satirists. They find humor in the subversion of a stable social community." Carrie Rickey, Philadelphia Inquirer. The premise of Club Paradise was inspired, in part and improbably, by Gillo Pontecorvo's 1969 film Burn, starring Marlon Brando. During his newspaper days, my dad had flown to Colombia on assignment to interview Brando and write an article about the production. Burn addressed issues of colonialism, political intrigue, and corporate exploitation of native people in the context of a sugar plantation on the fictional island of Caymada. My dad, still in his institutional phase of comedy, wanted to explore some of the same dynamics in regard to tourism in the modern-day Caribbean. Sort of like Caddyshack, but on an island and with black people. So he and Brian Doyle Murray teamed up again to write the script. My dad told the AV Club that as they wrote, they envisioned Bill Murray and John Cleese as the leads, with Bill as the laid-back guy and Cleese as the over-the-top guy. And we ended up with Robin Williams and Peter O'Toole, with O'Toole as the laid-back guy and Robin as the over-the-top guy. The polarities shifted, and it was probably not as interesting or as solid as it might have been if Bill and Cleese were there. The rest of the ensemble cast was filled out with Jimmy Cliff, Twiggy, and some hilarious SCTV alums. Both my mom and Erica have silent little cameos, travel agent and bar hottie, respectively. But sadly, I didn't make it into this one. I did, however, get to spend about 3 months in Port Antonio, Jamaica during the filming of the movie. My mom came to visit for a few weeks, but I was mostly on my own there for the duration of the shoot. This didn't seem at all unusual to me at the time because I was used to being alone with my dad, and I enjoyed a rich social life on the set and at the resort where we were based. My mom was content to be at home doing her art and never loved hanging around the set waiting in line for my dad's attention.
Since Erica was busy doing actual production work now that filming had started, I had a new babysitter, Rachel, and the intermittent company of Robin Williams' son, Zach, Twiggy's daughter, Carly, and Michael Schamberg's daughter, Caitlin. I'm sure we were expected to do a few hours of schoolwork every day, but I don't remember much work getting done. We went to the beach a lot and took trips into town to go to the markets, visit old sugar factories, and hike up to various beautiful waterfalls and caves. Some weekends we would do big group excursions to other areas or take rafting trips down the Rio Grande, stopping along the way to eat jerk chicken from flimsy outdoor kitchen stands in the middle of nowhere. Early on in the production, and unbeknownst to me at the time, my dad and Brian were arrested by Jamaican police for marijuana possession. Oh, well, we were being stupid and driving around at night with a half pound of ganja in the car, my dad told me, years after the fact. I'd heard stories about the Jamaican police, so I tried to slip them some money with my license, but they did not like that at all. It was bad. We were cuffed pretty quickly and taken to a cell in the local police station. After a nerve-wracking few hours in jail, they were allowed to access a production folder that Erica had prepared with a list of local contacts. Number one on the list was the Prime Minister. Needless to say, they were released immediately. Like the movie itself, the production was a bit of a mess, but lots of fun. Club Paradise, unfortunately, flopped. My dad attributed this partly to a glut of island movies that came out around the same time, but since none of those movies did particularly well either, anyone seen Water with Michael Caine? No? I think that probably wasn't the main reason for its lukewarm reception. Don't get me wrong, Club Paradise was definitely underappreciated, but something about it just didn't work. Even though movie making is a completely collaborative effort, as the captain of the ship, my dad was clearly not on his A-game. In retrospect, my dad was probably reaching burnout status in terms of drug use and was likely distracted by the impending changes in his personal life. I don't say this as an excuse, but just to provide context for the faltering of his previously spot-on comedic and commercial instincts. The Split. After we got back from Jamaica, my dad said he had something important to talk to me about. We sat down on the pastel-colored, splatter-paint-covered couch in the living room, and I nervously began picking at a stray blob of pink near my right knee. He took my hand, cleared his throat a few times, and asked, "How would you feel if your mom and I separated?" "Fine," I answered quickly, relieved that no one had died. In my head, I remember thinking, "Finally! Now I'll have them all to myself." I didn't know what a midlife crisis was, let alone that my dad seemed to be having one. I don't use the term midlife crisis in a flippant way. There is something developmental, existential, about reaching a point, let's say turning 40, where you seriously reevaluate the choices you've made in life, and perhaps decide that this is the time to make a change. To mark this turning point for himself, my dad wrote the words, "New life," on an index card and taped it inside a kitchen cabinet. I understood the concept of divorce and was okay with the idea of it, or at least I thought I was, in part because I thought it would mean that I would get more of him without my mom there to interfere. I didn't realize that it really meant that I'd get less of him than I'd ever had before. "I'm in love with someone else," he said. "I'm in love with Erica, and I'm not going to live here anymore." "Okay." The mini-adult me nodded, smiled, and assured my dad that I understood and was fine with what he had just told me. I could tell he was nervous and worried about me, and I didn't want to add to his stress or be seen as a problem that needed to be fixed or, worse, avoided. The child me had no idea how much this change would transform my life, both for the better and the worse. Oddly, my mom was completely taken by surprise. She had been fine with their marital arrangement of low-key and respectful non-monogamy, but says now that it never occurred to her at the time that he would leave. "He was always so dependable, and we had been together for so long. I didn't think it would ever change. Looking back, I guess we were more like brother and sister than husband and wife, but I was okay with that, and I thought he was too." Perhaps my parents could have gone on in their patchwork way for a time, but my dad was clearly not getting what he needed from the marriage, and was starting to worry that if he didn't make a change in his life, he would end up losing it to drugs, depression, or some combination of the two. I knew a lot of other kids whose parents were divorced, and so I didn't feel any stigma around the news, but I wanted to be sure to maximize the opportunity for drama. The next day at school, I gathered my little posse in the bathroom and cried and told them what had happened. One of my too-smart-for-her-own-good friends said, "He's leaving your mom for the secretary? Typical." I guess she read more gossip mags than I did, because at that age, I had no clue what a cliché it was. Cliché or not, Dad and Erica were crazy about each other and wasted no time settling into a semi-traditional domestic situation. I think their romance had started in Jamaica, but they always maintained that they did everything above board and waited until my dad told my mom. Regardless, the transition happened quickly. Erica retained her apartment for a few years, but in reality, they moved in together right away, living in a series of hotels and efficiency suites, some nicer than others. There was the Sovereign Inn, where I slept on a squeaky cot in the living room and watched the roaches run around on the ceiling after the lights went out. Then there was the Oceana, with the daybed in the living room covered in a polyester disco print. Next up was the Shangri-La, which we stayed at for about 6 months. Eventually, they ended up renting an apartment in the penthouse, a building that is literally stuck to the side of a cliff overlooking the Pacific Coast Highway and the Pacific Ocean. It was a cool apartment, and they stayed there for about 3 years before buying a house in Santa Monica Canyon once my parents' divorce was finalized. The divorce itself was very civilized. My dad was generous and fair, and my mom was not interested in cashing in, so there was no haggling over money. Same with custody. We should all be so lucky to divorce as well as they did. Unlike my parents, Erica was not from the Midwest and was at the other end of the baby boomer spectrum. Born in 1955, she was raised in Santa Monica, the middle child and only daughter of Daniel and Catherine, Kate Mann. Daniel, a lauded film director, was something of a tyrant, and Kate, an actor and artist who had grown up poor in Oklahoma, battled her own demons throughout her kids' childhoods. Erica had taken on the role of protector of her mother and younger brother and learned early on to be finely attuned to the moods and needs of those around her. Coming of age in the late 1960s, she embraced the flower child spirit and used to ask Kate to drive her and her best friend down Sunset Boulevard while they leaned out the windows yelling, "Peace! Love!" to the hippies on the street. She had not been a wild teenager herself, but had seen enough of her friend's drug use to feel that the risks far outweighed the rewards when it came to substances. Financially abandoned by Daniel after a messy divorce, Kate and Erica lived in the Zen Center in downtown L.A. in the late 1970s. Downtown L.A. in the 70s and 80s was a far cry from the hipster haven it is now, and Erica decided that she had to find a way to make a saner and more stable life for herself. Like my mom, she had gone through this very difficult and dysfunctional childhood, but whereas my mom came out of it all edges and angles, Erica was like a soft, warm blanket that wrapped itself tightly around you and tried to snuggle you to within an inch of your life. Erica was not only completely different from my parents, but once she got together with my dad, she was unrecognizable from the fun companion she had been to me when she was getting paid to play. I think she must have read some books about step-parenting that warned not to let the children from the first wife interfere with your new relationship, because right off the bat she had a lot of rules and boundaries. There were to be no secrets, meaning I couldn't tell my dad anything without his telling her. I was no longer allowed to get in their bed if I had a bad dream. She still apologizes for this one. She was always very concerned with what was appropriate or not appropriate and did everything she could to unparentify me. Having gone through several years of therapy around her own childhood, specifically the way in which the parent-child relationships had been inverted as Erica became like a mother to her own mother, she wanted to protect me from as much of that as possible and was determined that I be treated age appropriately. My feelings on this were mixed. On one hand, I liked having what I thought was a more traditional family structure than I was used to. "Maybe she'll bake cookies," I remember thinking optimistically. On the other hand, I did not like being treated like a child, even though I was one, and moreover, I did not like having my relationship with my dad regulated by her. I couldn't believe how he just went along with everything she said. Where was my hero now? Prioritizing his own happiness for a change, I guess. It was tough. The loss of Erica as my friend only added to my confusion and sense of betrayal. I suppose I felt abandoned by my dad and angry with him for turning my already upside-down life on its head. But since he was all I had, it was Erica who bore the brunt of my emotional upheaval. To be fair, it couldn't have been easy for her to make the transition from employee to girlfriend slash stepmother, and I know we were all doing the best we could in a complicated situation. During this time, I bounced back and forth between equally uncomfortable worlds as we experimented with lots of different variations of joint custody. The first iteration was Monday with Mom, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday with Dad, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with Mom. Reverse, repeat. Eventually, we went to alternate weeks, then switching every 2 weeks, and ultimately, I would stay with one parent until I couldn't take it anymore, and then move. It didn't bother me at the time, but I guess in retrospect, it was a lot to deal with. For some reason, no one thought to get me doubles of anything, so I would go to school on my switch Fridays with a huge duffel bag filled with my clothes for the week. Erica and my dad were happy, were in love, and had a very active social life. My mom, on the other hand, was mostly depressed and alone. One night, a few of her friends decided to throw a divorce party, and someone brought a 3-tiered wedding cake with a bride on top and the groom's feet sticking out from under the bottom layer. My dad, mensch that he was, even made a brief appearance at the party to toast my mom and thank her friends for their support. My parents did some joint therapy at the time, and we had a few family sessions. Erica and my mom even went together once. There weren't any knockdown, drag-out fights between my mother and father, or any malicious bad-mouthing between my mom and Erica, but it was not a happy time for me or my mom. Although things were amiable between them, my mother had hoped to remain close friends with Dad and was very hurt that he rarely spent time with her or sought her out on an individual basis. "Are you sure you don't want to get back together?" she would ask jokingly when he called, even 20 years after they'd split up. I vacillated between feeling left behind by my dad, displaced by Erica, and stuck alone with my mom, who was going through her own turmoil and could not be there for me in the way I needed. Long after the fact, Dad told me that he briefly considered filing for sole custody to try to shield me from my mother's sadness and unpredictable moods, but worried, rightly, that if left completely alone, my mom would not survive the separation. So, like all children of divorce, I did the only thing I could. I adapted. I struggled to make sense of my former, now fractured family, and did my best to fit into the two new ones that had taken its place. Because of their highly different parenting styles, there was a fair amount of code switching required by me as I traveled between the two homes. My mom let me paint my nails and wear what I wanted, while Erica forbade nail polish, dangly earrings, and any clothing she felt was too sexy. My mom's house was very solitary. Generally just the two of us, with me watching TV in the living room and her listening to the radio and painting in the kitchen. My dad and Erica, on the other hand, were much more social and would host lively dinner parties with lots of people. My mom was very unpredictable, and I could never be sure what kind of mood she would be in or what little thing could send her into a rage. Remember the double stick tape? Sometimes I would tread lightly around her, and sometimes I picked fights depending on my own mood. My dad and Erica were much more stable and nurturing, but there was something oppressive about the amount of communication that was expected. "Does it look like I care how my messy room makes you feel, Erica? So what if I'd rather roll my eyes a million times than share my feelings about being forced to eat broccoli? And no, I'd rather not do a 5-minute free write about how I felt when you wouldn't let me wear a tube top to school. Thanks, though." True to their usual nonconformist style, my parents bought a house in Ojai together as they were separating. They got an amazing deal on the 7-acre property and historic Wallace Neff home, as Ojai was just starting to emerge as a spiritual, natural, and artistic sanctuary. My mom wanted to be there as much as possible after the divorce, which meant we drove out there every weekend, listening to her eclectic mix of cassette tapes of Terence McKenna, James Brown, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Ram Dass, and the soundtracks to Out of Africa and The Last Emperor. My mom made this house her project and would spend hours in antique shops and flea markets while I sat in the car reading and pouting. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, the Sweet Valley series, anything by Judy Blume, and those creepy V.C. Andrews novels were my go-to books, and I read them all obsessively several times. Did I mention that I spent a lot of time waiting in the car for my mom? She could spend hours going through boxes of doll parts or old postcards or fabrics until she found that one magical item to complete her decorating vision. Once, trying to scare her, I lied that a policeman came to the car and asked me where my mother was. I said that I'd told him I didn't know where she was, but that she was short, with curly hair and bright blue Reebok high tops. Her response to this was not, "My God, maybe I should stop with the antique shopping so my daughter doesn't get kidnapped by a psycho," as I'd hoped. It was, "What do you mean short? I'm taller than you." My feisty little mama was not buying my girl in pink Volvo in peril story at all. And truthfully, I was fine. But there was something about the orphan anxiety fantasy that I kept going back to during that point in my life. What if she never comes back, I would think. Would I eventually walk back to Santa Monica on my own? How would I feel as a motherless child? Would people feel sorry for me? What if someone shot her while robbing the store? How would anyone know she had a child waiting for her in the car? Antique stores can be dangerous. Once the Ojai house was furnished, my dad and Erica also used it occasionally. They would invite friends up for the weekend and cook a big brunch and walk around the property picking wild blackberries, but they never really loved it the way my mom did. I didn't like being there because I didn't want to be away from my friends, my shows, and civilization in general. But to her credit, my mom did everything she could to try to make it fun for me. My friends were always invited, she installed a tetherball pole, and she even got a little rabbit ear TV set that never quite worked. Still, I think I just wanted the security and consistency of home, while she, understandably, just wanted to get away. In 2007, they sold the Ojai house to an interior decorator who stripped it and flipped it to Reese Witherspoon. Better homes and gardens, ha! My mom sneered as she clicked through the online gallery of the house. Better for who? It was perfect just the way it was. My mom, for better or worse, has never changed. She is still the same whip-smart, quirky, confrontational, artistic, and adventurous person she always was. While this has not always made things easy in terms of our mother-daughter relationship, we've learned over time how to appreciate our respective strengths and weaknesses and are now very close. Still, at 8 or so years old, I would have traded in her out-of-the-box brilliance for a little tender loving care any day of the week. Mystery Baby. One afternoon in September of 1985, in the midst of my parents' separation and the official beginning of his relationship with Erica, my dad picked me up from school and told me we were going to visit a friend of his, Amy, at the hospital. "Who is she?" I asked, knowing the name sounded familiar but not able to place it. "Amy's a friend from work," he said. "She directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High." "Oh, yeah," I giggled, wagging my eyebrows and making kissy faces. "I liked that one. Is she sick?" "Nope, she just had a baby." "Ooh, can I hold it?" I asked, still enamored with all things reproductive. "Probably not," he said. "She's brand new and very tiny. We're just going to say hi and then leave." "Can we go to McDonald's after?" "Sure." When we got to the hospital, I remember seeing Amy, pale and exhausted, looking down at me from the bed, and a tiny baby sleeping in the bassinet by her side. After a couple of minutes, the nurse came to take the baby to the nursery, and the three of us walked down the hall together to look at other babies in the unit. All the infants were crying, and it distressed me. "Isn't anyone coming to pick them up?" I asked my dad and Amy. "Doesn't anybody care?" There was uncomfortable silence. I was only 8, but I could tell that something weird was in the air. Amy was nice enough, but did not seem particularly happy to see us, and my dad was definitely in a hurry to get out of there. About a year later, I was snooping around in Dad and Erica's room. "Joy of Sex in the Nightstand Drawer? Check." And, opening Erica's diary to a random page, I came across the following sentence. "We just found out that Amy Heckerling's baby is Harold's baby, too." "Say what now? Harold's baby?" I was Harold's baby. How could there possibly be another? Despite my shock, I didn't say anything to my dad or Erica about it. I did bring it up to my mom, however, over our respective breakfasts of grape nuts with 4 sugar cubes, me, and 1/2 watermelon, her, when I was 10 or so. I don't know if I was compelled by genuine curiosity and a need to process, or if I was just being my usual troublemaking self, but all of a sudden I just blurted out of nowhere, Did you know about Dad and Amy Heckerling?
Yes, she said carefully. I knew. They had an affair, and she was really in love with him. But then he and Erica got together, and...
Why do you ask?
She looked at me unwaveringly with her clear green eyes, but swallowed audibly. I remember hoping she wouldn't cry.
Did you know they have a baby together? I asked sharply.
Oh. I thought he wasn't sure. She looked away.
He told you?
No, I overheard him talking to Erica about it. Don't tell him I told you. She agreed, and we both hastily dropped the subject. I tried as best I could to put the whole thing out of my mind. For all my precociousness, I was confused by the whole situation. How could my dad have another baby but not be with it? Did that mean he wasn't really its dad? Was the baby part of our family? Why didn't he tell me it was his baby when we were at the hospital? Why did my mom seem so sad? I could have asked these questions, but I didn't. I preferred being in the dark, scared of whatever the answers might reveal. I figured as long as everyone else was keeping the secret, I would too. When I was about 12, my mom and I went to a good friend's performance art show and party in downtown L.A. As soon as we walked into the courtyard of the theater, my mom said, "Violet, Amy Heckerling is here, with the girl." Oh, great, I thought. This is the last thing I want to deal with right now. Visiting Amy and the baby in the hospital and then talking to my mom about the situation had been enough of this other daughter to last me a lifetime. I was already annoyed about being at the show in the first place, and this encounter threatened to push me over the edge. "Can we leave, please?" I moaned. I didn't even want to come. My mom completely ignored me, too curious to care that I was not in the mood. The girl, who was probably around 5, had a mop of fiery red hair and danced around among the partygoers. I could barely look at her. "Ooh, she looks just like Harold, doesn't she?" my mom whispered conspiratorially. "I don't know, maybe," I said sulkily. It was true, but I didn't want to accept it. My dad and I were fighting a lot during that time, and here was this sweet little sprite who could just dance into his life at any time. It worried me, but I couldn't admit it. I don't know if I was also somehow ashamed of this mess he'd made, but I had emotionally distanced myself so much from the issue that it didn't sink in at all that this little girl was my half-sister. I was at the height of my preteen angst and just didn't want to think about or deal with anyone else's drama when I had so much of my own going on internally at all times. After that close encounter, I managed to put this little mystery sister out of my mind for the most part. She had her life and I had mine. It seemed strange to leave such an important loose end flapping around in the breeze, but I had no control over the situation and no interest in sharing my dad with anyone else. If all of the adults in the situation were fine ignoring it, who was I to stir the pot? Nothing to see here, just move along. 1 in 3. Between the ages of 9 and 10, I was molested by my mother's boyfriend, Adam, not his real name. This was her first real relationship after she and my dad split, and it was nice to see her happy with someone. It's hard for me to say molested because I felt, at the time, like an instigator, maybe even a willing participant, or at the very least, a curious kid. He was fucked in the head, obviously, and primed me with European art books showing naked kids, articles about parents having romantic relationships with their children, and whatnot. I knew it was wrong, but I didn't really care. I had always been very curious about sex and was partly caught up in the excitement of it. I was also partly scared of what would happen if anyone found out, especially since I had clearly asked for it by being a flirty, pubescent tween who was looking for love in all the wrong places. I felt like I was getting a real education in the 30 minutes here and there when my mom was busy or at the store. Mostly, he would tell me stories of his sexual experiences, and I would partially undress while he jerked off. Occasionally, he touched me or asked me to touch him. I started to get increasingly uncomfortable with the situation, but didn't know what to do. How could I just arbitrarily stop what I had started? Finally, after witnessing a nasty fight between this douchebag and my mom, I told her. I think I actually wrote it down on a piece of paper because I couldn't bring myself to say it.
Adam wants to have sex with me. She immediately told my dad. The police came to interview me at school with those anatomically correct dolls so I could show them exactly what had happened. We talked to the Santa Monica district attorney, and my dad asked if I wanted to go to trial. I said no. Later, in the parking lot, he said, "Do you want me to kill him?" "Not really," I said, relieved that he didn't want to kill me.